So we move now to part three of the book of Numbers, which is the journey from Kadesh, that right to the east of the Jordan. Now, some facts. Intense archaeological research in recent years has put us in a better position to understand the account of the wilderness journey from Kadesh to the northern border of Moab, which is the Arnon River, as well, to understand better, the heroic military victories in Transjordan that are narrated in chapters 20 to 22 of the book of Numbers. In the introduction to the second volume of his commentary, Baruch Levine, a Jewish writer obviously, writes, and this is the key insight I'd like to share with you, the priestly writers of Numbers sought to trace all that subsequently became important in the Israelite religion and society to the wilderness period. I think I've said that in my own words, but there it is from a scholar. They tried everything that happened in their religion up to the time they're writing, and that's still going on, like up, not still now, but going on from the 5th, the 4th, the 3rd centuries BC, constantly rethinking it all. They wanted to put all that back into the wilderness journey as it became their big story for their own story. Let's have a look at that then. The priestly school has included later cultic developments in the revelation given by Yahweh to Moses. These are my words now. We find this same retrojection here in this narrative section. Not only the laws, but in the stories. Whatever stories may have been handed down in the oral tradition, the written sources used by the priestly writers in this section belong to a period centuries after the period of the Exodus, most likely in the middle of the 9th century, with the result that places are described in terms familiar to the readers at the time of writing, and as the authors imagined them to be back then. So, they're writing the beginnings of the stories that we're developing and not yet written, but seem to be later, 9th century, that's 800s or something, and they're talking about what was going on then, and they're pushing it back into the wilderness period, which I'll kind of prove for you in a minute. Our task in reading these stories is not to expect accurate history or geography. If we do, we'll be shockingly disappointed. Rather, we're to look for what it is that the authors are saying about God. This is, and they're not always right on that, of course. It was said to you of old, but Jesus said. But they're doing their best, and they're saying some wonderful things about God, but also some very imperfect things, because they're responding to God the best they can. So we're looking for what are they saying about Yahweh, brackets, and then we have to check that by looking at Jesus to see whether it was right or not right, or half right or very right or whatever. And they're looking to talk about Yahweh's will for them as a people, and they're trying to find that out and discover it, like the fathers of the Vatican Council were trying to see what does God want of the Catholic Church in the 20th century. You know, that's the question they're asking. And they didn't get it perfectly right, but they gave us something marvellous. And how his people are to listen and respond if they want to experience Yahweh's blessing. That's their aim. What is God really like? How are we to respond to God? What does God want of us as a people? But they're writing to their contemporaries and they're projecting it back into the wilderness period. Okay, let's take this a bit further. Numbers 20, 22 to 29, we find the death of Aaron. They set out from Kadesh, and this is in the last year of the 40 years. And the Israelites, the whole congregation, came to Mount Hor. Then Yahweh said to Moses and Aaron at Mount Hor on the border of the land of Edom, "Let Aaron be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land that I have given to the Israelites, because you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah." They struck twice. "Strip Aaron of his vestments and put them on his son Eleazar." Moses did as Yahweh had commanded. Aaron died there at the top of the mountain. Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain, and when all the congregation saw that Aaron had died, the house of Israel mourned for Aaron 30 days. But the high priesthood has been handed on. Numbers 21. When the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev, heard that Israel was coming by the way of Atharim, he fought against Israel and took some of them captive. Then Israel made a vow to Yahweh and said, "If you will indeed give this people into our hands, we will utterly destroy their towns." We'll wipe them out. God was pleased with that. So Yahweh listened to the voice of the Israel, handed over the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their towns, and the place was therefore called Hormah. Now, that's the story, and it gives you an idea of God and what God might want of them, not to intermarry with people who aren't pure race. Let's get some facts. There's no evidence of urban settlement at or around Arad in the late 13th or early 12th centuries. None. So there was nobody there at the time of Moses. So we're not dealing with history. We're dealing with a story. In the book of Judges, chapter 1, verse 16 to 17, written in a later period, they talk about Arad. It was there then. It was a significant enough place. But not at the time they're projecting it back into history. Chapter 21, verse 4 to 7. From Mount Hor, they set out by the way of the Red Sea to go round the land of Edom. But the people became impatient on the way and spoke against God and against Moses. Here they are complaining again. "Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There's no food and no water, and we detest this miserable food." Then what did Yahweh do? He sent some poisonous serpents among them, and they bit the people so that many Israelites died. The images of God you're getting are not very helpful. But that's what they thought God was. It's in the Bible, so you've got to be careful. "The peoples came to Moses and said, 'We've sinned by speaking against Yahweh and against you. Pray to Yahweh to take away the serpents from us.' So Moses prayed." He's the intercessor. "And Yahweh said to Moses, 'Make a poisonous serpent, set it on a pole. Everyone who's bitten shall look at it and live.' So Moses made a serpent of bronze and put it upon a pole. And whenever a serpent bit someone, the people would look at the serpent of bronze and live." Some facts. The story of the bronze serpent fits with other Near Eastern texts that speak of sympathetic magic exercised in a context of invoking the gods. In this case, the notion is that harm caused by the serpents is counteracted by a serpent that is the divine vehicle for healing. I'm just thinking, is there any comparison here between, was it, who discovered, if you give yourself a little bit of, Madame Curie, wasn't it? Yeah, no, you know, if you give yourself a little touch of Sorry, can't hear. You give yourself a little bit of the disease and your body can beat it, and you build up antibodies against it, that kind of stuff. So this is psychologically a bit like that. By gazing upon it, those bitten by the serpents open themselves to the divine blessing. You probably remember, the Book of Kings, by the way, talks about this bronze serpent as being in the temple. So at one stage, they did have a bronze serpent in the temple. Some kind of, and so the story gets retrojected back into the, that's why, have we got the bronze serpent here? Because, and they tell the story about, and in the New Testament you see it in, they will look on him who is pierced, the healing that comes from the cross. So there's a little bit of play with that kind of imagery. Because it's a poisonous serpent that was killing the people. What is your point?
But God said, make a poisonous serpent.
That's right.
And he made a serpent of bronze.
That's right. Because it was the poisonous, that's the sympathetic magic. A poisonous serpent is killing the people, so you make a bronze image of that poisonous serpent, and it has the contrary effect. I don't understand it, Helen. But that's the reason. It had to be the same as what was causing the trouble. And now this one will heal. But I'm not into sympathetic magic particularly, so. Now they start here. So we've got the Wadi Zered here, the Zered Gorge. There's the Dead Sea and so on, the Jordan River. And so Numbers 21, 10 to 20, they journey around the Moabite territory. They don't go in. Numbers 21, 21 to 3, they defeat Zion, the king here of the Amorites. And you see this in the Psalms, Zion. And then this appears to be an imaginative retrojection into the wilderness period of the 10th century Israelite military victories in Transjordan. Because there wasn't enough here in the time of Moses. This was basically in Bedouin territory. So, but at the time of the, in the 10th century and into the 9th century, there were battles here, and so these were defeated. So the story gets again pushed back into the Moses period. And then Numbers 21, 31 to 35, they defeat Og, the king of Bashan. So there's defeats all the way up there, victories before they enter the promised land, and then certain tribes are set up in that area as well. But probably what happened, the most likely thing is, that's when the Israelites, they spread over here 3 or 4 centuries later into that area. So they're trying to trace their origins back to the time of Moses, but it doesn't actually work. Well, that's as much as I want to take with you today, because next week I want to do quite thoroughly the chapters on Balaam, because they're quite interesting, and then take you through to the end of the book of Numbers.
So they must have travelled with arms, and if they were
yes.
going into...